I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and our guest today is author Matteo Ascarapore, whose debut novel, Black Buck, was the Read with Jenna pick on the Today Show in January and a New York Times bestseller. We talk today about writing satire, reader critique, and the ways that Matteo looked to other authors as inspiration before he ever wrote his book. The Stacks Book Club pick for February is The New Wilderness by Diane Cook, and we will discuss the book in detail on Wednesday, February 24th with Van Newkirk. If you love this podcast and want to be able to discuss books you read with other book lovers and generally believe in supporting the work of artists you appreciate, please consider joining the Stacks Pack on Patreon. That's a website that allows you to make a monthly contribution in exchange for perks like our virtual book club, discounts on merch, and shoutouts on this show. If this sounds like you, please head to patreon.com/thestacks and join. Here are some of the newest members of the Stacks Pack. Christine Wiedner, Amy Stewart, Grace Pickering, Leah Beige, Erica, Heather Peter, Kate Carter-Brown, Sarah, Shannon Elliott, and Lauren Hurd. Thank you all so much for your continued support of my work and the Stacks. Okay, now it's time for you all to hear from author Matteo Ascarapore. Hi, everyone. I'm so excited. I'm here today with Matteo Ascarapore, the author of Black Buck, the book that is, I don't know, everywhere. If you've not seen it yet, you must have your eyes closed or something. I don't know. Matteo, welcome to the Stacks.
Tracy, I made it.
I'm so
happy to be here.
You're the first person who's ever wanted to come on this podcast. So thank you for appreciating the show.
What do you mean? I listen to this all the time and I'm like, oh, I can't wait to one day be able to get there and answer this snack question or whatever.
Oh, good. So you're ready for this. We'll save it for later, but I'm excited that you thought about it because sometimes I ask that question and people answer everything around it but the snack. And I'm like, I don't actually care where you write. I'm just concerned about, are you eating goldfish or yes or no? You know, like that's all I want to know. We'll get there later. Let's talk about the book. 30 seconds or so, tell us about Black Buck.
Black Buck is about a young man named Darren. He's living in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn with his mom, his girlfriend, his best friend, and he's also working at a Starbucks in Midtown Manhattan. One day, this really suave white guy named Rhett Daniels comes in, and he's the CEO of a startup called Someone, S-U-M-W-N. And he says, you know, give me my drink. Darren, for some reason, sells him on another. And Rhett Impress invites him to the 36th floor, which is where his company's located. He invites Darren to join an elite sales team, and Darren reluctantly says okay, and he soon realizes he's not the only black salesman there. He's the only black person in the entire company. So he goes through hell and back to make it to the top, and once he's there, you know, he has power, status, and money, but he says, I don't want to be the token black guy. So he hatches a plan to help other people of color infiltrate America's tech startup sales teams, redefining what it means to be a minority in the workplace.
Boom. It's like you've talked.
Is that 30 seconds?
I don't know.
I cut some stuff out.
Well, don't give any spoilers, but I feel like you've done that before. Talked about your book, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, just a couple dozen times.
Okay. I want to talk about, there's a lot that I want to talk about in this book. So I'm going to try to keep my questions short. We'll see how this goes. First and foremost, I want to talk about audience, because I've heard you talk about, and I've read things you've said about this book around you not really intending for it to be satire, at least when you started out. And I've also heard you talk about writing this for black audiences, and if white folks are into it, like, cool, enjoy, come along on the ride, I think, or some version of that. And so my question for you is, like, when you're writing something that is maybe not fully satire, but satirical or humorous, and you're talking about race and you're centering black characters, but, you know, you live in America and you know white people are going to read it, how do you navigate that humor and, like, to make sure that white people aren't laughing at us, or that black people feel seen in a certain way? Or, like, how are you navigating that? Are you at all? Do you care? Like, what is that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And you have definitely done your research, Tracy. So for me, what made it all simple and helped me focus was knowing that I was writing for black people. And I often extend it to black and brown people, just due to the fact that, you know, we do have struggles and triumphs specific to each other and our own backgrounds. But much of what we experience today sometimes overlaps, especially in the workplace, or especially right in the prison system. So for me, gaining that clarity of purpose on saying, I am writing this for black people, I am writing this for people such as myself who have been in these white majority workplaces and broader environments, allowed me to not pander to anyone, to not even really consider the white gaze. And it gave me a freedom to write in a certain way where I'm not thinking about writing in mixed company.
Right.
If you know what I mean, right? So it's like, I'm not thinking like, oh, should I not say this joke because white people, you know, might not get it, or even non-black people might not get it? Or should I not write this joke because they're watching and then they're going to be laughing at us rather than with us, or XYZ? I just didn't really think about them all that much, to be honest. And it's funny because someone who read the book said, hey man, you know, you're really putting white people through the ringer. Like, you know, why is Darren taking that approach? And I said, listen, man, like, how do we speak? This was a black person. How do we speak when we're just with each other? That's what this book is. Right. But at the same time, as you mentioned, Tracy, I knew that white people would read this book and I welcomed it, but it's more so for them to come along the ride, and for them to, see Darren's story and also see the narrative, and then ask themselves, what role do they play in it? And what role do they play in the broader narrative of this nation and the fight for justice? But at the same time, I'm not their tour guide.
Right.
I'm not saying, take my hand, let me show you what it's like to be a black man in America. That wasn't the intention.
Right.
But focusing on black people, helped me break out of tropes of just 400 pages of tragedy and trauma.
Right.
Right. There's so much joy in there. There's so much humor, and there's so much absurdity at racism, you know, or at racism's expense, because while it is dangerous and pervading and disastrous, it's also really absurd in so many forms.
OK, but so let me ask you this sort of follow up question then. Well, let me ask you this mini follow up question and then the big one. Is your editor black?
No. Okay. My editor is non-black, but a woman of color.
A woman of color. So how do you navigate? You sit down, you write this book, you sell it to HMH, you work on it, you do your revisions, you're working with an editor, you're working with someone who is not in, you know, who's not identified as black. How do you then negotiate that, especially knowing that editors' jobs are to make books sellable to broad audiences, right? Like, that's like one of their huge jobs. So how do you navigate your want and desire to eliminate the white gaze from your work with this other outside force that is working for, like, broad appeal? You know, like, how is that something that is even difficult, or was it something that just sort of happens easily?
It wasn't difficult. And it goes back to our first conversation. When I spoke with her, I felt deeply that she understood what I was doing and wanted to bring out more of that rather than change it or transmogrify it into something else that was more hideous or more palatable to other people. So at point during the process, and I'll just give a shout out to Pilar Garcia Brown at HMH. At no point during the process did I ever feel like Pilar was trying to make my book more commercial or more this or that. In every instance and with every edit, it felt as though she was trying to bring out my intentions further and sharpen them and also help me to be a more empathetic writer as well. She smoothed out some rough edges and the book has enough rough edges, right? And sharp points that can poke many people in different ways. So it just goes back to our first conversation, and I trusted her and she trusted me. She didn't come in here saying, well, you know, I don't really get this black thing. Are you sure you want it? Never. There was never that. She trusted me as the expert of my book. As did many other people at HMH and my agent. So I'm just grateful for it.
That's beautiful. I feel like that's not always how people have experiences in publishing, especially black people and other people of color. So it's great to hear that that was something like you felt supported in your work. I love that.
Yeah. And to keep it real on that point, I know you didn't ask for this, but you know, the title did come into question though. Right. On the flip side, the title did come into question where some people said, hey, you know, we get the historical connotation and it makes some people uncomfortable. Can you explain or can you tell us the background to that title and how you chose it? So after I did that, it was no issue. But I will say, yeah, that was a point where people wanted a little bit more information.
Did you always know that you wanted the title to be Black Buck, or was that something that were there other options that were being floated around?
There was an original title which was actually called Fixing the Game. But at some point I was like, I don't know if this really captures what is going on with this book. And then I was gonna call it Buck, and then I said, why not just Black Buck? It hits on so many points, but beyond that, it captures the essence of what's going on in the narrative of a young black man bucking the system while at the same time, you know, potentially being viewed as that historical black buck that was going to burn down the plantation and steal the women and the pigs, you know what I'm saying? So and there's other definitions of it in terms of black wealth, right? Black buck, and he is a black man renamed Buck. So that spoke to me most deeply and sincerely. And after I explained that, there were no more questions.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, I have one more question about white people and then I'm going to get off of it. But the reason I have so many questions about this, and I'll just be really straight up, is that I, as you know, I'm on Bookstagram and I've read a lot of reviews from other folks and other people's opinions, you know, after I finished the book. And I, you know, with something that is satirical, even if that wasn't your original intention, I feel like people get it or they miss it. Mm-hmm. Like, and like that goes for me too. Like I read, what's that George Schuyler book?
Black No More, is it?
Black No More, yes. Yeah. And that's a satire. And like some of that, I was like, I'm so confused. I don't get it. Like, where's the joke? So like, this is not, your book totally worked for me. I was all in on the humor and I like got it, but like some satire doesn't work for me. So like, sure. I understand people who don't get it or aren't quite sure what the joke is or what the exaggeration is. So, and because your book is about race, I'm obsessed with this idea that it was like picked by Jenna Bush Hager and like all these white women are reading it. And like, that's really interesting to me. And so normally I don't focus so much on the white gaze, but like your book is kind of positioned in this really interesting place in my mind, being satire and being like a Today Show book club book, and then like knowing that you didn't plan for it to be like, you plan to write this book for black people, and then seeing it be positioned in the world, like, and seeing so many white women like being like, I read this book. And so I'm just really interested in your feelings and thoughts about that kind of intersection, because also just to tack on to my non-question, which is that I remember I can't remember where it was, but Ta-Nehisi Coates, after Between the World and Me came out and got really popular, he sort of had a reckoning, he said, where he was wondering why so many white people were loving his book and like because he intended it, you know, as a letter to his son and also like as something for Black folks, and then having it have this huge success and with so many white people, he was like, what did I write? Like, why is this so resonant for them? And I'm wondering if any of that feels resonant to you, like especially having it be picked again, like by Jenna Bush and like be on the Today Show and be like really lauded by so many white people. I'm just wondering, what is that? Do you reckon with that? Or are you just like, great, yay?
That's a lot, Tracy. That's
a lot. I know. That was a lot.
No, you might have to edit it. I'm going to try to not be too long-winded while also hitting those points. So I don't know why Ta-Nehisi Coates was surprised with many works by Black people, for Black people, white and non-Black people are drawn to them. Because there's a certain level of voyeurism of let me see how they are talking about themselves or the world or us amongst themselves. So I knew that white people and again, non-Black people would read this book and be able to take away a lot from it, even if those people weren't who I had in mind, right? Two things can exist at once where I wrote this for Black people and I am happy that white and non-Black people are reading it. Mm-hmm. That's what's going on in my mind, but in my heart, it's the same. I'm happy about it, but what makes me happiest is the fact that it's not just white and non-Black people who are celebrating Black Buck. Black people are rallying around this book in such an intense and extreme way. The messages that I get from so many Black men, women, and other identifying individuals of all ages who say, you wrote about me.
Yeah.
I've been here. I've been down. It might not be one-to-one. Their environment might have not been a workplace. It could have been a predominantly white institution. It could have been a sports team. It could have been a religious organization. So the fact that these people feel seen, it's huge for me every day that I get one of these messages. In terms of the satire, Tracy, I blurred so many lines in this book that sometimes you don't know what's real and what's what, right? There's a damn pig in the office, right? That's a little spoiler. That's the most of a spoiler I'll give, right? Okay. There's a pig in the office. That's a little absurd. I did this all on purpose of blurring these lines. And the people who take the time to dissect them and put in the effort to get to the end, even though I understand for many people it's difficult. For many people of all backgrounds, there are things that are triggering. But I truly believe that if people make it to the end, they will see my intentions and they will see the broader messages, because it's not just one message. But for those who don't get it, or for those who are turned off by the use of certain language, or see that a woman like Jenna Bush is praising the book and say, oh, how Black could this book actually be, right? Or limiting what it means to be Black or to write a Black book. That's okay. Because something that I've learned almost more than anything else from this process, Tracy, is that authors are not entitled to the benefit of the doubt from readers. We are not entitled for readers to read our entire books. We are not entitled for readers to give us rigorous feedback or a rigorous review. We are not entitled for readers to do a deep dive and understand every single thing so that they can see that many of us, or at least me in this instance, had very positive intentions. Mm-hmm. But for those who don't get the satire or read the book and are like, yeah, not for me, or detest the book, I still thank them for reading it because as of now, that's a very small minority, and I'm just grateful for the outpouring of love.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk about Black readers now. I know we spent a little bit of time on white readers, and I think I'm done with that for now. We'll see if anything else comes up. I want to talk about Black readers. First of all, we have a little biography overlap. We both went to NYU.
I didn't know that. What?
Yeah, I just heard that on an interview. You mentioned that you went to NYU.
That's what's
up. Yeah. Okay. So we're fighting violets / bobcats.
Whatever
you want to be. Yeah. So love that. And I feel like I'm also from the Bay Area. So though your book takes place in New York, I know many people who have worked in startups on both coasts. Mm. And I really feel like you captured that, like, I'm going to try to be nice, but it's not really nice. That like earnest obsession with like changing the world. In a way that's like so icky to me, like just like truly icky. It's like, you work at Instacart, like, great, thank you for delivering my groceries, but also like, you don't pay your drivers, so like, what are we talking about? And I think that you kind of tap on that in the startup culture at Someone. And I also think you tap on, like, obviously the racism in these predominantly white spaces. And so, and I know that some of that overlaps with your biography, having worked in startup culture and sales. And I'm wondering, like, how much did you have to add to enhance it, to make it feel satirical or not, maybe not satirical, but to make it feel like fiction, to separate it from the truth of your experience? Or was it, is this pretty much what your experience was? I mean, obviously you're not Darren. I don't want people to think like you're Darren or like, and there's a lot of fiction in the book, but as far as like that being a Black person in those spaces and the like earnest superhero of like Facebook type gung-ho-ness, I just wonder how much of that felt like extra versus what you lived.
So you're right, I'm not Darren, and Darren's experience isn't mine one-to-one. I was very intentional about that from the beginning, and that if I were to write about my life, I would have become too obsessed with the blow by blow of my own history, and trying to render everything accurately to a T, that I don't think it would have been as relatable to many people who have been in these types of scenarios or environments. As for the world of startups and sales specifically, no, I didn't really have to add anything. If anything, Tracy, I had to remove a lot. I mean, the first draft was 168,000 words, right? Whoa. What's the final? It's about 110, 113,000 words. So I had to cut out almost like a whole book, basically. And I had added so many things related to sales and the world of startups, but it was just too much because for many people who come to this book, they're unfamiliar with those worlds. And it would have just become too muddled if I would have included absolutely every part of those environments that I wanted to include. In terms of my own experience, right? I didn't have the overt racialized experience that Darren did in the workplace. There was definitely, it feels weird to even say casual racism or passive racism.
I know what you mean.
More, you know what it, you know you mean, right? Well, many of us call it microaggressions, where it's innocuous or mundane to the point where you're like, did that actually happen? But in your heart, it feels like the world is splitting before you because you're like, whoa. I am the only Black or brown person in the sea of white. And if I were to speak up, then there would be 50 or 100 or even just 10 people who would gaslight me. But I did experience overt and bizarre racism outside of the workplace, especially when I was younger, in the environment that I grew up in, the sports teams that I played on, and so forth. So I wanted to translate that experience into the workplace. Not to make it hyperbolic, but to show and express how it feels for so many of us in these instances. Because it's not always someone saying, oh, do I need to translate this pitch into Ebonics so that you get it? Sometimes it is just people rolling up and be like, hey, brother. You're like, yo, brother. Or what's up, my man? My man, who are you talking to? You know, or we also see it in the book where in the beginning, it's funny because everyone's saying, and then anyone ever tell you that you look like Malcolm X? Then it's like Martin Luther King. Then it's Dave Chappelle. Then by the end, it's Drake. I almost thought about throwing Oprah in there or someone like that to really hit home the point. But the people who read that book, and white readers told me as well, where at first it's funny. They're laughing. But then by the fourth or fifth time, they're like, does this actually happen? And if so, what does it feel like for the person on the receiving end? And the last thing I'll say to this point, because I feel as though I gave you an incomplete answer. What I feel like resonates with many white people who read this book and send me, Tracy, I've gotten so many emails from 60 plus year old white women who say this book really spoke to me deeply. What I believe resonates with them most deeply is that they are seeing race and these issues rendered in a way that they're not familiar with. And it's putting them through the ringer, but they feel as though they've learned a lot by the end to help them become better allies rather than putting a performative Black square on Instagram. So I think that's the draw for many of them. And when they do reach out to me, I respond. You know, I'm kind because I am thankful for them taking the time for having read the book. They didn't have to do that.
Right. I wonder, I'm sure there's a huge difference in the kinds of emails you get and the things that resonate with people depending on age and race and like location 100%. And stuff. Like, I'm sure it's just like some people like, oh my God, I love the pig. And then some people are like, oh my God, I love the this. And you're like, wow, I could tell you exactly who you are, where you live and everything about you by which part of the book you liked or didn't like.
Tracy, you've seen the reviews. Many Black bookstagrammers are like, wow, this spoke to me so deeply, but I would have caught a body. Like I would not have put up with Clot. I would have killed him. Or there are other people who are like, I've been in this scenario and I know what it feels like to be shocked into silence at the same time. So
that's me.
You're exactly right. The responses do range.
I also, maybe this was in the LA Times piece on you. There's this great quote you have about a trip to Italy and I didn't write it down and I should have, but do you know what I'm talking about? The line?
I remember. It's that the most dangerous thing any person of color can do is forget they're a person of color.
Yeah.
That might be paraphrasing.
In an unfamiliar
territory, exactly. Yeah.
And that was really, like, I think that that's, like, such a... Even though that has something... is not in the book and it has to do with, I guess, a personal experience that you had...
It speaks to it, though.
That is the book to me. Like, mm-hmm. that really encapsulates everything that is the book because I think so much of it is Darren... forgetting who he is and then remembering mm-hmm. and then forgetting again and remembering and
it's
like
the sunken place.
1000% the sunken mm-hmm. place. Okay. I want to talk about this book coming out right now in the beginning of 2021. You write the book, I think you said in 2018. You know, books take a while. They have to go through all the editing, whatever. So you're sitting on this book and the summer of 2020 happens. And you're a Black man, and you know you have this thing coming that speaks to a lot of this. And mm-hmm. then there's also, like, you know, the crazy white supremacy part of what's going on in America also throughout the summer and all of the, like, you know, I think what that guy that I'm not going to name on CNN, you know, the white lash or whatever. Mm-hmm. What is it like sitting on this, knowing that this thing that you've created is going to enter the world at this time?
Yeah. It's tough because when everything was happening in 2020, right? And everything, meaning these murders, these public executions and HDTV, mm-hmm. while the world is locked down. And they can turn away with it, but they can turn away from it, excuse me, but it's harder to than ever before. Mm-hmm. With all of that going on, I got pulled into the undertow of it. And I just, you know, it hit me really hard. Because it's just cumulative, as you know, where it's not just 2020, it's 1920, it's 1820, mm-hmm. 1620. Mm-hmm. And this summer, you know, especially after watching the execution of George Floyd, I was like, damn, you know, when is this going to stop? Is it ever going to stop? And then after sitting on that, sitting with it for a couple of weeks, I mean, I'm not going to go into it, but I got like paranoid around that time. I thought about getting a piece. I'm not going to lie. I was like, especially like where I come from and some things that I was saying on Facebook and the reaction I was getting, especially from white people, I was like, yo, should I get a piece to like protect myself? And then I was like, that's stupid. I was like, chill out. What are you talking about? Like, you know, you're inviting bad stuff. But after I worked through all of that, especially with the help of some friends, like my friend Candace, who wrote Everybody Looking, the YA novel. I believe you read it, right? She's a close homie because she's part of the colony, just like Jason Reynolds and those folks.
Jason mentioned.
I know. I thought about it. after working through that, I was like, okay, I got this book. And people all around me are like, wow, can you believe it that it's coming out during this time? Like, this is going to sell a bunch of copies. This is, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm not really thinking about the commercial aspect. That's cool. I mean, I always hoped that it would sell and do well and resonate with people and be relevant. But I'm writing about this from the perspective of, you know, a person in 2018. And there are other people who have written about this in the 1960s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So I'm not writing for a moment. But what made me feel good is that hopefully this book could help facilitate some of the tougher conversations that are happening right now. But beyond that, allow people who may feel alone and who have been in scenarios like Darren to know that they should never, ever be made to feel less than. And they have the same right, just as much as anyone else, no matter who they are, to chase success and in some cases achieve it.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Sounds good.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in store. And now save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, we're back. I want to just, before we kind of transition more into your process, I wonder if there's anything. So I think some people on podcasts ask this question of like, what do you want readers to take away from your book? And I sort of hate that question. So mm-hmm. I've come up with my own version of it that I'm mm-hmm. sort of working through, which is, what do you think readers should keep in mind while they're reading your book? If anything.
Ooh. Ooh. This is a good one because I am used to that. I am used to that other one. What do you want? When you were saying that, I was like, yo, I already sort of used the response that I typically yeah. get for that.
So well, that's like, the thing. It's like we talk about the book for 20 minutes and people tell me what they think about their book and what they hope that their book does and all of that. And it's like, to ask that question again is sort of like, well, was I listening? Like I sure. have been listening. So I'm just curious, like, it's sort of like, what's your helpful hint for the reader as they try to crack your book or whatever else that means to you?
Yeah. That feeling is the purpose, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not looking to really change your mind. I'm looking more so to have you feel something, and not just one thing, but many things. So if you are going through the book and you are happy when Darren's on the rise, great. If you are upset when other things are transpiring, great. If you are sad at certain points, great. That was the purpose. I wanted you to feel something because I believe that that feeling is going to stick with you longer than anything that you think about in terms of the book.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then I have one more question about the book and then I really will get off it. I have to know how you named your characters, because there's one character in particular whose name just really spoke to my heart. And so I'm just curious how you came up with the names.
Can I ask who was that character?
Well, yes, I can tell you. But I feel like if you're a listener of the podcast, you should know, because it's from my favorite book and movie, Gone with the Wind, Rhett. And I was wondering if Rhett Daniels was at all related to Rhett Butler in any way.
No, but let me tell you something that this man told me. He said, hold on, man, this might be a stretch, but Rhett Daniels, Rhett Butler from Gone with the Wind, and Lee Daniels directed The Butler. So is that how you came up with the name? I said, nah, man, but I like that. Another interview, a guy said, okay, Mateo, Darren Bender, and he changes Darth Vader? I said, nah, man, but I like that too. So the names are important for most people, just to run you through a couple, right? Darren, there's no real significance in terms of his first name, but his last name in Spanish means to sell. Right. So it's a foreshadowing of what would happen. For someone like Clyde Reynolds Moore III, his surname is the combination of two of the white enslavers from the roots. From 1977. So Mr. Reynolds, or Master Reynolds and Master Moore. And that's just giving you the vibe of Clyde a little bit. You have someone, especially the black folk who come in later in the book, Rose Butler. Rose was named after a 19-year-old woman who was hanged in Washington Square Park in Manhattan for arson. And you see Rose as this fiery character coming with the heat and sort of just slapping the hell out of Darren. A few other people, Ellen Craft. That was a woman who was white passing and she escaped. She was a runaway enslaved individual. Same thing with Jacob Green, who's also in the Happy Campers, which if you don't know what the Happy Campers are, listeners, you're just going to have to read the book.
Read the book.
Brian Grimes, the enslaved man who ran away was actually named William Grimes, but I didn't want to change his first name just because I liked it. I liked Brian. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there are significance to many of the names in there. And there's a lot
but
of other
Rhett
Easter
Butler.
Eggs. Nah, Rhett. No, there's no real significance with Rhett. That just came to me. And Rhett Daniels sounds like this could be an actor in GQ. And he is that suave, good looking type of white character where you're like, he's not that bad. Like Matthew McConaughey or someone like him.
Matthew McConaughey, who turns out is terrible. But
yeah. On the face, he seems like a nice guy. And I think he hangs out with a lot of black people. But yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, he has a lot of black friends, as they say. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about you and your process. And you know, this is a question that I know you've been preparing for, which is, how do you like to write? Where are you? How many hours a day? Is there music? Are you in your house if it's not a pandemic? Are there snacks and beverages? Are there candles? Are there rituals? Give me the vibe.
So I actually haven't prepared for this. I just remembered an inkling. So now I'm just going to have to give it to you. I write in a corner of my apartment facing a white wall. And in the past, there would be nothing in front of me. But now I've since put up a couple of reminders and a poster of Muhammad Ali staring at himself in a mirror while training. Just to remind me that it all happens in the training process. And during practice, not so much when you actually get to the stage, right?
Practice.
Are we talking practice? So that's where I write. I write with a very uncomfortable chair that I've had for years. And I think of the sculptor Rodin, and he in Letters to a Young Poet, which was written by Rainier Marie Rilke. I'm completely butchering that name. Rodin tells him, you know, you can't sit in a comfy chair as you work. Like, you're not here trying to relax. You're trying to work. And I thought about that, and that stuck with me. I write during the day. My process starts really the night before. where I tell myself you're going to write the next day so that when I wake up, there are no ifs, ands, or buts. It's just automatic in the same way that I'm going to eat, in the same way that I am going to take a shower. When I wake up, I'm not going to run you through the whole process because it's pretty in depth, but there's meditation, there are waffles, there is my beverage of choice, yerba mate, which I'm almost always drinking. And then after watching 2 to 3 hours worth of music videos or movie trailers and dancing around, then it's time to hit it. I'm finally ready. And I write for a couple hours, 2 to 3, sometimes more, but typically just 2 to 3. And then I'll either have other engagements, or in a pre-COVID world, I would have tried to relax outside, see some friends. So that's part of what's going on. Yeah. But when I was writing this book, it was different because I was consulting with tech startups, and I was actually in your area of the States. I was in the Bay Area like 6 times in 2019.
Wow. Yeah. Where in the Bay Area?
SF, and specifically Soma, I believe was the neighborhood. Yeah.
South of Market.
Exactly.
There you go. See, look at me. I'm a real Bay Area girl. I'm from Oakland though. So
not
a city girl. Anyways. Okay. I love the waffles. I love that you watch music videos because you're like the only person who still watches music videos. So
what?
For you.
I'm on YouTube, man. They're out there.
I guess. I don't know. I miss like MTV days, like TRL. The good days. Okay. I've heard tale that you tried to write 2 other books before this book, and you were writing about other things that weren't necessarily like your exact, or not exact, but related to your experience. And then you had some sort of an epiphany or felt ready to write this book. What were the other 2 books about?
Yeah, the other 2 books were just different versions of the same idea. And I did write them. They were for me talking about training or practice. And they were for me the training ground to figure out what it meant to write and be a writer, which are 2 things that I'll always be figuring out. But I was more so ruminating on them back then. But those 2 books, they were actually YA. And I didn't know that I was writing YA until I pitched an agent the first manuscript, and she said, you need to age down the character, and this is YA, which was actually bad advice, to be honest. It was like horrible. Like, you need to write what you want to write and then keep characters however old you want them to be, and really don't listen to all this other advice from people other than yourself. Like, stop it. Those 2 books, though, they were somewhat tangential or related to my own experience. They're about a young man who felt as though he was an other, someone like Darren in this workplace. And then he basically finesses his way into a volunteer program in Kenya. And he goes over there to you're laughing. You're like, what? That's crazier than Black Book.
is this also like a funny book, or is this a serious book?
No, it's a serious book. It's pretty serious.
I thought it was like another satire type vibe. And I was thinking oh my God, I can't wait. I love this.
It's a lot more. No, these 2 books will never see the light of day, but it's a lot more serious than Black Book. And he gets into this this volunteer program where he is working at an orphanage. And part of why he went over to Kenya, on the face, it was to just build up his resume, because he's in college at this point. But the real reason was to figure out what it means to be Black, but on the global scale, because he knew what it felt like being a young Black man in the States, but he wanted to better understand what it meant in relation to other people. And in his mind, he was going to go to one of the quote unquote blackest parts of the world, Africa and specifically Kenya. So there's a lot more, but yeah, those 2 books are never coming out. So that's all the folks will get.
That's it. A teaser. Maybe maybe parts of them will appear in your future work. Who knows?
Maybe.
So you started writing the book in 2018. Do you remember what sort of stuff you were watching, reading, listening to while you were writing the book?
Yeah. Around the time when I came up with the idea, you brought up that epiphany, Tracy. That was November 2018, and it was through the help of many things, but chiefly reading On Writing by Stephen King. His just no-nonsense, non-esoteric, blunt advice for writing really spoke to me in a way that a lot of this like established and institutional guidance for becoming a writer doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of that works against would-be writers because you feel as though you have to write in a certain way for a certain type of people or go to the right schools. And a lot of that is just rooted in the canon, mm-hmm. which is being changed right now. So around the time that I was reading on writing, I was watching this documentary on the Black Panthers, and I was just really, really fired up. And I was like, yo, I'm about to write a book about elite Black salespeople who blow up a bunch of shit. And I was like, actually, okay, you know, I refined that idea over time. But I was reading a variety of things. I was reading some Philip Roth. I like Philip Roth a lot. I think that him and Toni Morrison are two of the smartest people to have ever written. Toni Morrison, obviously, you know, being ahead in many ways just because of who she is and what she had to do in order to write these masterpieces. I was watching a lot. It's really hard to even
say. It's hard to remember.
Yeah, it's hard to remember. I read The Sellout, but I read that before I actually started writing Black Buck because I remember specifically that it was giving me the confidence that I needed to write something that would push the envelope, mm-hmm. in a similar way to what Paul Beatty did, not exactly one to one because that book is crazy. Yeah.
I like that satire. I got that one.
You got that one. Okay. Yeah. For some people
that
like,
hard.
What is
a lot
this?
Of people did not get that book and they were like, this is what?
This is crazy. I read Behold the Dreamers by Mbola Mbwe. I love that book. Black Docker by Usman Semben. It's a hard book to find, but I really enjoyed that. Tar Baby by Toni Morrison. Heads of the Colored People by Nafisa Thompson Spires, my homie. Okay. Just a lot. Papillon, I liked that French book about that inmate who escapes. There was a lot. The Intuitionist, which was actually acquired by my agent when she was an editor, and is of course a Colson Whitehead book. Friday Black by Nana. If He Hollers, Let Him Go by Chester Himes. There's just so much, but beyond what I was reading, I was going to a ton of readings, all the time, you know, in New York City, just to sort of through osmosis get the energy of these people who are on stage and just trying to picture myself on stage as well one day, being able to speak to audiences. And that's why, you know, you and I joke around with it, but I did have The Stacks as a podcast that I wanted to be on because I've listened to folks like Jason on here or Kiesa Lehman. I remember specifically laying down in Prospect Park, listening to Kiesa Lehman and him talking about his guilty read, which for me is my same guilty. It's the same guilty read for me. So when he said that, I was like, he said it. I remember where I was listening to Jason. And then, of course, yeah, Jesse and all these other people on here. So being on here is a milestone that I wanted to hit. And thanks for having me.
You're going to make me cry. That makes me so happy. I get so
emotional.
You're
doing a lot. You know, and like there are homies out here, you know, and I'm not going to get on this tip for long, but I tell some homies like Reggie, right, from Reggie Reads, or Joy from Smile It's Joy, or Tashe from Books on the Yell, or even Achille. You know, Reggie says, y'all are the rock stars to us. And I say, Reggie, you are all the rock stars to me because you are all coming out with a lot more unafraid and rigorous analysis of these works than other people in the so-called establishment. And most of you are just unafraid and you keep it real. So again, it's just a joy to be interacting with all of you and to consider you all my peers.
I love that. That's so nice. And I, you know, always shout out to Reggie because Reggie was the first person who ever believed in my podcast that wasn't related to me. Yeah, we like connected over. I posted something on Valentine's Day 2018 before the podcast ever existed about Stamped from the Beginning. And it was something that was like, happy Valentine's Day to like fighting racism or something like silly. And he just loved it. And we started DMing and he's been my like earliest champion and always a champion of the show. So I just love Reggie so much. And I love that you know him and love him as well. I am curious if any of the author talks that you went to stick out in your mind as being like particularly resonated with you or like, you know, because right now there's so many author events that are happening online where people are able to hear authors speak that they wouldn't necessarily be able to. So if there's anyone that you feel like was particularly inspiring to you just to get on people's radar, if they ever see their name pop up, like hosting an event or anything like that.
Yeah, a couple. One that jumps out to me is Morgan Jerkins. Morgan also helped me out in my career. She is someone who helped me launch in my career as an essayist. Right, I've written a lot of essays, and Morgan was the first person to say, hey, you know, I'm editing an anthology for Medium. Would you like to contribute? And she opened up my eyes to a lot and gave me the confidence to go and pitch and place a lot more essays. So thank you to Morgan. But what I loved most about Morgan's event, and I'd been to a couple before we actually became friends.
She was at Housing Works. And she was just so unabashed and just, she kept it a buck. And she told the audience how she took a gummy, I think in California or somewhere on her tour, like a weed gummy, and ordered lobster and just treated herself. Her just keeping it so real really spoke to me. Who else? Another was Kiesa Lehman. I actually saw him in conversation with Morgan Jerkins at the Brooklyn Museum. And what spoke to me, obviously, you know, Kiesa is just who he is. I consider him to really be like the Muhammad Ali of the literary industry at this point. He says what he wants. He's vulnerable. He's just speaks with so much rhythm every time that you're like, this is embedded in his DNA, because it is so hard to speak like that if you're trying. But yeah, what spoke to me about that event was he was just really vulnerable. And I believe he got even teary-eyed on stage in front of so many people. And that vulnerability is something that has stayed with me and something that I try to always carry with me in my own events or these interviews. And there are so many people, and sometimes it's not even just because of the reading, but because of interactions I had with them at the end of the reading. Victor Laval, he spoke to me at the end of his reading. What I used to do, Tracy, to be honest, is I would wait. I'd be the last person in line while they're like signing books or doing something, and I'd ask them for some time.
Yeah.
And sometimes they would oblige me. And Victor Laval, before I chose my agent, he gave me some key advice. And just some advice that I really needed to hear at the time. And I've never spoken to him since. He likely doesn't know who I am, but that affected me deeply. So those are just some people. I mean, I met Nafisa Thompson Spires at Weeksville when she was reading. I didn't even catch her reading because I had to jump, but we sat next to each other. And, you know, then fast forward in time, she's hosting my launch event with me at Greenlight Brooklyn. She's someone I consider a friend and someone who I consider a model of someone in the literary space that, you know, I want to follow in many ways. So the connective tissue between all of these people and so many more is that it feels as though they are being their authentic selves as often as they can, and that they are giving of themselves so deeply, and that they are being vulnerable and not trying to pander. And that is something that I try to do with all of these interactions and also try to move with grace.
Yeah, I love that so much. It's true. I've seen events with almost all of those people. And obviously Kiesa is someone I consider a friend now too, and just think he's so wonderful and he's so tender and vulnerable and caring and just like what a role model, I think, at least for me. Okay, let's talk about, we're going to wrap up, but just a few little things before I let you go, which is, and you can tell me to fuck off and leave you alone and say, my book just came out, stop pressuring me. But do you know what comes next for you?
Yeah, I do. So I am working on another book. I'm not working on it right now because I'm so focused on promo for Black Buck. But yeah, I know what that's going to be. I'm also working on bringing Black Buck to the screen. As of this podcast, when we're recording it, no news has been announced, but maybe it will be by the time it comes out. And aside from that,
what kind of news? Like casting news?
No, not casting, but more so the medium that the book will take shape as on screen and the people that I'm working with. And that's something that I've been sitting on for like a year, to be honest, for the most part. Yeah. So it's been a minute. Aside from that, I'm just focused on new opportunities to interact with readers and other types of readers and putting my energy into getting the book in the hands of the right people at the right time.
Love that. And then for your readers who have read Black Buck, loved Black Buck, love what you're doing. What sort of stuff would you what other books would you recommend to them that are maybe in conversation with Black Buck? Not necessarily the same thing, but something that you think speaks to or is connected to it in some way.
The Spook Who Sat by the Door by Sam Greenlee, without a doubt. I read it only last August. And I was like, yo, my man wrote this in 1969 and we're doing almost the same thing.
Wow.
Same thing about someone bucking the system from the inside out. Satire, absurdity, intensity. Woo! Sam Greenlee, man. Rest in peace. He did his thing. How to Make a Slave by Gerald Walker. I recently read that. That also spoke deeply to me and resonated with me in the context of Black Buck, because he is using humor to underscore the horror of what it's like to be his specific type of Black man in America, especially at a predominantly white institution as a professor. So yeah, those two books speak to me. The Angry Ones by John A. Williams, that came out, you know, many decades ago, but he's talking about what it's like to be the only one. And yeah, those are just a couple books that are definitely in conversation with Black Buck and that I'm happy to have read.
I love that. And then who's the coolest person to you that's expressed interest or excitement or, you know, that's read the book?
Fortunately, there have been a couple, but it's hard for me to not say who I'm about to say, especially because we're friends now. And he has been a real source of guidance and brotherhood for me. But Jay Ellis. So Jay Ellis, who is most well known for playing Lawrence on Insecure, we began a dialogue last year after someone passed him the book. And over the past year, he has been nothing but a great friend to me. We've met up in person a few times. I can call him. I can text him whenever I want. And it's never an intrusion. And he does the same and he checks in. But I will say, you know, when he reached out and he was like, yo, man, I really like your book. Congrats. I was like, hold up, Lawrence? What the? And then I spoke to him on the phone shortly after. And I was like, yeah, this guy is cool as hell. And he does the work behind the scenes to usher in Black and brown creatives and artists. So shout out to Jay Ellis, man. Love you, brother.
Out. Love that. Okay, last one. If you could have one person, dead or alive, read this book, who would you pick?
What? That's tough. Dead or alive? Huh. Malcolm X.
Okay.
It's tough. There are so many, but I mean, I'd love to see what he thinks. If he's like, yo, man, like this, that, and the other isn't working for me. Or if he's like, yo, you know, I understand the 21st century is a lot different than what it was like for me back then. And you gotta rework your strategies for reworked racism. Then, you know, I don't know. I'm just so curious about what he would think, but many people. I wonder what Oprah thinks too. Shout out to Oprah.
I bet Oprah has feelings that I would not agree with.
I don't think Oprah's read the book. She probably doesn't like that line about Steve Harvey. But Oprah, if you ever read this book and you hear the Stacks podcast, shout out to you.
Yeah, Oprah. And please, if you're listening, I have a space for you on the podcast whenever you'd like to come on. We can talk books.
We'll bring Stedman too.
Yeah, Gail. Anyone you want. We can bring Barack if you want to bring your friend from Chicago. Like, it's fine, whatever. No, fuck that. This is about you, Mateo, star of today's episode. I will pander to Oprah another time. But Mateo's book, Black Buck, is out now in the world. You can get it wherever you get your podcast. I do want to do one quick shout out, which is I listened to a big chunk of this book on audio, and your audio book is one of the best fiction books on audio. Your reader is phenomenal.
Zeno Robinson, my man held it down.
It's so good. And so for folks who maybe pick up the physical copy of the book and you're having a hard time getting into the humor, just try listening to some of it to get a tone, because I think that the reader does such a good job of ushering in that sense of humor and the joy that we talked about and the intensity in a way that's really accessible. So if you pick it up and you're sort of like, I'm not getting it, try switching to audio, even just for a few chapters, to kind of get that that vibe, because I think he does just such a good job. But again, the book is called Black Buck. It is out there. Go get it. Mateo, thank you so much for being on the Stacks today.
Tracy, thank you for having me. This is a dream come true.
Yay. And everyone else, we will see you in the Stacks. Thank you to Mateo for being our guest, and thank you to Taryn Roeder for helping coordinate this interview. Remember, the Stacks Book Club pick for February is The New Wilderness by Diane Cook. We will be joined by Van Newkirk for that discussion on Wednesday, February 24th. Please make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, take a moment to leave a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter. And check out the website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirajis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.
Have you ever wondered how to say good morning in Italian? Or what is goodbye in French? You can ask Alexa. Just say, what is happy birthday in German? Or how do you say hello in Japanese? Do you want to know how to say I love you in Spanish? Ask Alexa and start learning a new language today.